Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is my friend Steve Greenfield, and he's going to talk about a Forbes article that he read the other day about student loan forgiveness. So we haven't talked in a couple of weeks. Steve, how's everything going?
Everything's okay. How are you?
I'm doing okay. So I sent you that Forbes article the other day. What was your impression of it?
Okay, well, here is the article, and here's why I'm so interested in talking about it. Because ordinarily, I wouldn't really care about the content of an article that's this specious in its reasoning and so clearly agenda driven. By banking or people seeking to be, well-paid motivational speakers on the banking convention circuit, which is, a big part of what this author's writing is about. The problem is that raised my interest in addressing it is that it's been near the top of news aggregators for a couple of weeks, already. Those aggregators, things like Google News, Yahoo News, they are self-generating as to the placement of articles based on how frequently an article is being read, how frequently it's being clicked on, shared in social media and then clicked on by other people. The positioning is really generated by clicks, not by somebody's personal interest in treating something like an important headline. And so when you look at the news aggregators, you get a strong sense of what people are reading, what people are circulating. And so that's the problem with this particular article, is that it's obviously being read a lot. And so that's why I'm giving it my attention. It's obviously out there influencing people. And so it then, as a result of that, and not on the nature of its completely nonsensical content, it wouldn't generate any attention for me whatsoever. But strictly on the basis of its reach at the moment, which is sort of defying comprehension, to me at least, on the basis of the quality of the arguments being raised in it. Now, for starters, the article is written by someone named Zach Friedman, who is listed here as a senior contributor on personal finance for Forbes magazines, which is, of course, a business-oriented magazine, although not a technical magazine or a trade magazine of any particular kind, but just sort of a general survey business interest magazine, very widely read, big-selling magazine. Now, under the author's name, he lists this as his blurb: best-selling author, I write and speak about leadership and greatness. Now, that is, could you imagine how somebody can go around with a straight face telling people that they are an authority on greatness? That's why you should buy my books. That's why you should hire me as a highly paid speaker on the public speaking circuit, because I'm an authority on greatness. I can't even imagine what that means. I can't even imagine that that's not like in The Onion. Like, that would be a parody of somebody's blurb. That would be in a satire site. But this person with a straight face, says that he writes and speaks about leadership and greatness. So, with that as a caveat, that's what we're dealing with. And again, in the modern, pay-per-click era, that this particular author is receiving such huge travel into public consciousness. You should be closing this article at the moment you read his description of himself and his career. So be that as it may, he is claiming to write an article that explains the terrible things that would happen if the student debt forgiveness programs of either Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, which differ from each other to one degree or another, but if either of them were to actually become policy, he is writing an article that claims to explain all the negative things that would happen, which he feels are rather dramatic, and he goes into them one at a time. And so aside from the the lack of logic behind the arguments themselves, and the fact that they are all, you know, sort of designed to be fear stimulators without any evidence behind them. There is also the matter of how many things about the proposals from Sanders and Warren had to be eliminated from the discussion, even to make the fear factor available for the writer to create. And so I'll sort of go quickly over what he's saying, because it's a very short article that's bullet pointed, so that's not a time consumer here. Then maybe you know, we'll take a break there, see if you have any questions about that, and then I'll go a little further into it.
Okay.
For starters, before he gets to his four bullet points, he is claiming, without directly citing, some study by Moody's, another banking institution, another banking research institution, that there would not be much of a stimulus to the economy from making this $1.44 trillion available to the current loan holders to be able to spend, and is claiming that they would have a very minimal effect, similar to a tax cut-like stimulus to economic activity. So that's the one thing he's saying, is that releasing $1.44 trillion into the hands of a bunch of 30-year-olds would have, you know, would generate no significant economic activity. And we'll get back in a moment to why that's absurd. He's claiming the following four major bullet points. One, that it represents a moral hazard because future students might borrow more than they can repay because they know that it'll be forgiven. That's number one. Number two is that he feels it will lead to higher student loan debt on the grounds that, you know, if they don't receive that forgiveness sometime in the future, they'll be, having anticipated it, they'll be carrying even more student debt than they may have needed to borrow, and that will be, you know, more of a burden on the economy and on the individuals with the student debt than what we have now. He claims that there will be lower federal revenue because the federal government will lose $85 billion total in principal, interest, and fees if federal student loans are forgiven. And, of course, Old Reliable, it will also benefit wealthy borrowers because, you know, 0.1% of the people who hold these loans are wealthy enough to repay them. You know, so that's the four bullet points that he's making. And so, you know, then he's arguing that no one can predict the full economic benefit. He's almost arguing that everything he just said is speculative, and that anything anyone else is saying is speculative. Answers with several questions about the future of debt, such as, you know, well, does this mean the slippery slope argument, right? Could it mean that we need to forgive all mortgage debt and credit card debt or auto loan debt? Would borrowers who already paid off their student loans get paid back, et cetera? So, you know, it's kind of strange that here's an article that doesn't really say anything, that more or less admits in both its setup and its conclusion that it doesn't have the ability to say anything, and yet it then says five very specific things, all five of which are easily refutable. And so ultimately it says something about the state of discourse on critical policy issues in this country. In that somebody who has almost a satirical personal professional description atop his article can bookend his arguments by saying that, you know, these are purely speculative, and still be getting the kind of circulation that he's getting. And I think that the reason for that is this thing that we've talked about, you know, pretty regularly, which is that not many people these days are really seeking, you know, logically argued, you know, properly evidence-sourced arguments anymore. We, you know, we watch either MSNBC or we watch Fox, you know, or something in between that claims to have the two sides debating each other, because what we're really doing is rooting for the side that we find appealing. We're all operating from the standpoint of confirmation bias. We look for articles that seem to confirm things that we feel inside of ourselves and make us feel like we can now use that as a citation so that we could show that we're not tribally driven, that we're rationally driven. But we tend to be using source material that is very clearly not evidence-based, not logically argued, not sourced to solid, you know, evidence of any kind. And I think this is, you know, kind of what the crisis of our democracy has led us to, which is that nobody's really sure anymore what real facts are. I don't blame that on Donald Trump. I don't blame that on Fox News, you know, because, you know, we see on MSNBC when someone like Joy Reid can host a body language expert, you know, to come in and explain to viewers why Bernie Sanders is a liar because he has, you know, he has rounded shoulders. And people, you know, like that actually, you know, sells commercial advertising time on what's supposedly a progressive news source. You know, the same body language expert, okay, with air quotes around body language expert, you know, was just a couple of years ago appearing on Fox on Lou Dobbs to explain why Donald Trump's body language shows that he's brilliant and powerful. and she's a millionaire. Okay, Joy Reid is a multimillionaire. She's a multi-million-dollar annual contract. She's heralded as, an example of the achievement of black female journalists. Everybody goes straight to Identity, right, without even thinking for a moment about whether she actually does on television constitutes journalism. And so, again, you know, I don't blame Donald Trump. It's just been a generally corrosive process over the last 40 years by which people seek out information that make them feel like they have substantive reasons to be in the tribe that they're in, that it matters. And so, you know, here's just another example of it because, you know, this article is being used by many people who are supporting the other Democratic candidates, the more corporate ones, as a reason why we can't trust the policy formulations of the somewhat more progressive of the Democratic. But the article is complete nonsense. You know, it's absolutely complete nonsense from the, like I said, from the quasi-satirical blurb about the profession of its author to everything that follows. It's just utter nonsense. So I'm going to pause right now, give you a chance to, question or comment, because I know that you're going to want to know why the different sections of what he wrote are nonsense, but I'm going to give you a chance to come in here.
But, you know, it's being circulated around the internet, and, you know, people have access to it. So is this is playing to one particular segment of the population that think debt forgiveness is the wrong way to go. Am I correct?
Yes. He's trying to explain basically to people who are not stakeholders in banking and bank loan collection that their own lives are somehow intersect with what the banking industry wants in the student debt collection process. It's
okay.
Really important and first of all, it's important for everyone to understand that unless you are personally an owner of student debt, unless you personally own some piece of student debt, whether it's a direct connection between you and a bank or whether you bought one of these chopped up derivatives of the loans as an investment instrument, that your personal ability to profit from that depends on the banking industry's power to collect the loans. Let's get one thing straight right away. You have no stake here. You have no horse in this race. You are absolutely none of us, except a tiny, tiny fraction of the population that profits from the collection of student debt. So we're talking about maybe 0.0001% of the population, because we do have, 260 million employed people in this country. So not many are direct stakeholders in how or when or if this outstanding student debt is going to be collected by the banking industry. So that's number one. None of us have any stake in this whatsoever, as compared to the 45 million people who hold the debt. And you may be someone who wants to marry one of those 44, 45 million people, but you can't because he or she is so burdened by student debt that you're unable to take on the expenses of marriage, that you're not going to buy a house. You're not, you know what I mean? Like, so there are, you know, whatever, 100, 150 million of us that are direct stakeholders in this matter being resolved, but there are almost none of us that are, direct and indirect beneficiaries of it being resolved, plus everybody who would benefit from the spending it would free up. If you own a restaurant, if you own a movie theater, that you know, 45 million people in their 20s and 30s are going to suddenly be able to consume your products, where up until now they're not, because all their money is going to a bank. So I would say that practically everybody in the United States is either a direct or an indirect stakeholder in this debt being alleviated, and almost none of us are stakeholders in it not being alleviated. So you have to get that in your head, you know, directly right away. If you are involved in this issue at all, you're involved in it as someone who would benefit from the alleviation of the debt. And there's under no circumstances do anybody except tiny number of people who are collecting these debts reap any benefit from it not happening. So that's number one, right? The whole nature of putting an article out in the public is to convince ordinary people that they somehow have a horse in this race. So let's just start by dispensing with that. If you're listening to this podcast, you don't have a horse in this race. So that's number one. You shouldn't even be concerned with the content of the article. But having said that, let's get to the content of the article. Let's get to that first thing that he said before he got to his four bullet points, which should have been its own bullet point because of the emphasis that he puts on it, that tax cut, that it would have a minimal, only tax cut-like stimulus to economic activity in the near term. This is absolutely false and easy for anybody to understand. First of all, we don't have general tax cut stimuli to our economy, because all the tax cuts we've had since 1980 have been very, very heavily weighted towards the extremely wealthy people who are in the upper tax brackets, right? I mean, that goes without saying. Mm-hmm. And so to give a lot of money back to somebody who's already so far beyond the income level of what they can consume and put all of their surplus income into investments as a way of storing their wealth, because they already can't consume any more than they're already consuming, that has very little stimulus effect on the economy, because in order for any kind of new revenue stream that opens up to have a stimulus effect on the economy, it has to be put in the hands of consumers, people who would actually spend more money on consumption if you gave them more money. And so that's where the first argument fails that he's offering on the grounds of it. In fact, the people that are the targets of the student debt relief proposals are people who are by definition between the ages of 22 and 42, because that's the payoff range that people take out with their student loans, 10 to 20 years, with the majority of them being in the 10-year and 15-year range. So you're talking about people who are literally at the peak of their personal consumption. You know, by the time a person's in their mid-40s, they're oftentimes already trying to save for retirement. They're trying to pay for their own children to go to college or save in preparation for their own children. But the student loan holder demographic age group is people who are both, you know, in growing income earning potential and at the peak of their interest in spending on themselves. These are spenders. Every penny is going to get spent. You know, they'll buy health insurance, they'll go to the movies, they'll whatever it is that they'll do with the money. You know, they'll put a down payment on a house. This is absolutely almost as close to 100% a consumption budget that's going to be made available as any form of stimulus could possibly be. These are people that are basically not spending this money in the general economy, because they're spending the entirety of that money every month in just one industry, which is the banking industry, right? That's right. All they're doing. So mm-hmm. let's just dispense with that on the face of it. is that it is targeted for people between the ages of 22 and 42, nearly exclusively. Yes, there are some older people who, you know, went back to school to pursue a second career or whatever, but the overwhelming majority of this money is going to people from 22 to 42 who will be spending most of it. So that's number one. You know, moral hazard, that future student borrowers could borrow more debt because they're expecting that, you know, when it hits the fan, they'll get the same relief that, that people are being offered right now. In order to make that argument, you have to completely forget that these proposals include making public colleges tuition free. And so the future debt issue isn't relevant to the discussion unless you pretend that that wasn't bundled with the proposal. You know, it would make it possible for anybody who wants to go to school without debt to do so, because the public colleges would be tuition free. This would also have a very important effect on private colleges that would not be tuition free, because just like back in the days when public colleges were tuition free, the private colleges would find themselves needing to compete for applicants, because so many people would want to go to the free colleges, even top applicants, you know, regardless of their income, just because with college costing $80,000 a year, the idea that you could save $320,000 before you start out, you know, in life having to pay your own bills by going to a public college would be a dramatic challenge to the financial paradigms of the private college industry. I remember this myself. You know, when I went to one of these colleges that now cost $80,000 a year, it only cost $8,000 a year when I went there. You know, and that was, you know, admittedly 40 years ago, but inflation has not been tenfold over those 40 years. It's only been about threefold. And, you know, college costs have been escalating, just like housing costs, fantastically beyond the rate of inflation. So that would be put to an end, whether it's by keeping costs down or whether it's by offering more direct grants for financial aid to people who need it so that they could compete for top applicants with the tuition-free colleges. That would then, you know, be the next effect of that. So there's no moral hazard. And on the moral hazard question, what possible greater moral hazard can there be than to put the entire private financial infrastructure of the United States of America at the same risk that we saw happen in 2008 when it came to pass, you know, or in the late 1980s, during the early 90s during the savings and loan crisis, or going all the way back to the banking collapse of the Great Depression? How many times do we have to be teetering on the brink of this cliff all the time and periodically go over it so that the Treasury Department has to bail out the banking industry on the backs of the same taxpayers that are holding these loans who are not getting loan relief as part of the bailout process? You know, what greater moral hazard can there be than that, you know, than the complete collapse of the financial infrastructure of the United States? So, you know, moral hazard, you know, it's a great slogan. You can put that on a bumper sticker, but also it's false and devoid of meaning other than to try to stimulate fear, because that's a great juxtaposition of words, moral hazard. I mean, wow, that sounds inherently bad. You know what I mean? If I weren't analyzing what they're putting into the calculus of this moral hazard and just we're looking at moral hazard, like, well, who wants moral hazard? That's not good, right? So, you know, so that's why we look at it.
Well, Steve, yeah. we only have 4 minutes left. Let me ask you this question. As November approaches, do you think there'll be more articles like the one you're talking about?
Yes. Yes, there will, because, you know, obviously the more progressive candidates are gaining steam in the public. Let me go through the others. I can go through them really quickly. Higher student loan debt. Yeah, no, there won't be higher student loan debt in the future for the same reasons that we just explained. It's come bundled with ending tuition at public colleges, and so there will not be higher student loan debt. Lower revenue, this $85 billion, first of all, it's you have to subtract interest and fees because that's not part of the picture if you're forgiving debt. So it's a lot less than $85 billion, but you're also talking about a number that's factored over a 20-year period. So even if it were, you know, $80 billion, that's $20 billion a year out of a federal budget. That's, you know, a couple of trillion dollars a year. So sounds like a lot of money to me sitting here at home, but it's a negligible proportion of the overall federal budget. And it also ignores the taxes that would be collected from the $1.5 trillion of new spending that's going to be generated among these, young adult demographics. So there's the dispensing with that. And the wealthy borrowers benefit. First of all, hardly anyone wealthy holds student debt, so that's nonsense on the face of it. And since all of these proposals are to be financed by increased taxes on the extremely wealthy people and by financial transactions within the banking industry, they're actually going to come out behind. You know what I mean? Like wealthy people and the banking industry are going to be the subjects of the taxes that are used to cover the cost of this debt forgiveness. And so there are definitely no wealthy people are going to benefit. And that's kind of at the heart of why they're making this pretense that wealthy borrowers will benefit, because what's really troubling them here is the part that they're not mentioning, which is that both Warren and Sanders are proposing that this debt relief be financed by taxing the banking industry and the people who benefit from holding stock in the banking industry. And very wealthy people. So that's the real concern. They're making up all this garbage about student loan forgiveness because of the one issue that really matters to them, which is that if implemented, it will be at least in part financed by increasing taxes on them. That's the part. That's the unspoken reality of why they're publishing these articles, pretending that you and I are somehow stakeholders in preventing this from happening, which is that it's really all about the tax being used being proposed to pay for it, not about that any of these things could actually happen if there's only one part that could happen that concerns them, which is who's going to be taxed to pay for it. So again, not my problem. You know what I mean? Like not your problem, not the problem of the 45 million people currently holding this $1.5 trillion in debt and all the people whose lives intersect with those 45 million people. Not our problem, right? It's banking's problem.
Yesterday was Iowa. There's no clear winner yet. And the primaries and caucuses are going to go on for a number of months. And I hope, Steve, you and I can talk as they do progress to talk about give everybody your analysis of what's going on, because I think you're terrific. And this is Steve Greenfield. And I'm Cynthia Pooler. This is All Exits Closed. If you like this show, follow us on Twitter. Thank you. Steve, have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Thanks.